Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop. Today's program is Update on Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia, or CLL. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations, and also many other blood cancer organizations. And it's because of that collaboration that we've been able to reach so many of you on the call today. And, of course, your interest in the topic. We have on the call today over 627 participants. You come from all over the United States, from all different parts of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Costa Rica, the Philippines, and the United Kingdom. So you really, it's a bit of a global call, and you really are from all over the world. Today's program was supported by a grant from AbbVie, Teva Oncology, Genentech, and Biogen IDEC, and I really want to thank them for their support of the program and also for their corporate collaboration in making today's program possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on the program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan O'Brien. Dr. O'Brien is Associate Director for Clinical Science, Chow Family Comprehensive Cancer Center, Medical Director, Sue and Ralph Stern Center for Cancer Clinical Trials and Research. She's Professor, Division of Hematology Oncology, Department of Medicine, UC Irvine Health. And Dr. O'Brien is going to address an overview of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, current treatment options, managing symptoms, complications, and side effects, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. O'Brien.
Hi there. I am going to try and compress all that into 15 minutes, and I'll start with the overview of CLL. As indicated by the name, CLL is a chronic disease, a leukemia where the patient has elevated, an elevated white blood cell count. This predominantly lymphocytes, as you can tell from the name. And this is a type of white blood cell. The white blood cell count is elevated, and typically how patients are diagnosed is many of them don't even have any symptoms. They just go to the doctor for a routine physical or something, have a blood count run, and are found to have an elevated white blood cell count. And so many, many patients have no symptoms at all when they develop CLL. We don't necessarily have to treat the disease at the time the diagnosis is made. And the reason is, as I just said, many people are totally asymptomatic. The disease is not causing any problems. They feel fine. And it's a very slow-moving disease, usually, as you can tell, again, from the name, chronic. And people can live many, many years with this leukemia. There are times when we do want to begin treatment. And what it really boils down to is if the disease is causing problems, and I'll mention what those might be, then we want to intervene because we want the person to feel well. So some of the side effects or symptoms that people may have include very enlarged lymph nodes that are bothersome or unsightly, a very enlarged spleen. If the person is developing anemia, a low red blood cell count, if they're developing a low platelet count, because you can sort of think of it that the disease is crowding out the bone marrow, and that's where all of the normal blood cells are made. There's no particular white blood cell count at which we need to start treatment. I have patients I've been following for many years, for example, who are walking around with a white blood cell count over 100,000. And to put that in perspective, normal is about up to 10 or 12 would be upper limits of normal. And yet, even though some of those people have very high white blood cell counts, they don't have any symptoms, they don't have very enlarged lymph nodes, they're not terribly fatigued, et cetera, and so we can just keep observing them. So basically, there's not one specific indication for treatment, but it could vary from person to person. So somebody might be having a lot of symptoms, whereas another person might not be feeling that badly, but they're starting to get anemic. And as a physician, we would want to intervene before they're anemic enough that they have a lot of fatigue or shortness of breath, which are the symptoms of anemia. Some people never need treatment for their disease. This tends to be a leukemia that is in older people, so the average age is about 71. That means at least half the patients who have it are over 71. And many will actually die of other causes, things that older people have that are problematic, heart disease, other cancers can occur, and so may never need treatment for the disease. There's about one-third of patients, I would say, roughly, who never require treatment. And in the other patients, over time, they may require treatment for the various reasons that I mentioned. Our current treatment options, in terms of initial therapy, are predominantly chemotherapy-based. There's one exception to that, and patients who have a chromosome abnormality in their leukemia cells, which is called a 17p deletion, meaning part of chromosome 17 is missing, don't do very well with chemotherapy, and they can be treated with ibrutinib. So let me come back to the chemotherapy for a second, and again, I'm going to give you an overview. Dr. Kipps is going to go into more detail on some of the new therapies. So typical chemotherapies are something called FCR or BR. And then in elderly patients, sometimes we use chlorambucil, which is a very mild oral chemo in combination with an antibody. And that's the standard for everybody except those with 17p deletion. Now, 17p deletion at diagnosis or at the time of initial therapy is uncommon, so we're really only talking about 5 to 8% of the population who would be a candidate for something besides chemotherapy. Can patients be cured? This is actually a little bit controversial right now. There's been recently some papers published suggesting that with FCR chemotherapy, there are a subset of patients who are still in remission 10 to 14 years later. And the question is, are those patients cured? Or are they going to experience a really late relapse? I'm going to go out on a limb, I think, and say that I do think that there is a cure fraction with chemotherapy. And so the obvious question would be, well, can we identify those patients up front? And we can with some of the prognostic factors. So we know that they're not high risk in the sense that they don't have a 17p deletion or another chromosomal abnormality called an 11q deletion. They have a mutated protein within their cells that gives them a good prognosis. They often have a chromosome abnormality called trisomy 12. So the point is, we can identify the population that may have a cure fraction and would still benefit from getting chemotherapy, even if there are newer drugs that are available, as you're going to hear about. But then there's a fraction we can identify who probably are not cured. But even in that population, they can get a remission lasting several years, and then the disease may come back. There are two new oral drugs that have been approved in the last 2 years that are not chemotherapy-based. They're called kinase inhibitors. A kinase is a fancy name for an enzyme. So what they do is they inhibit an enzyme within the cell, and by doing that, help the cell to die. One is called ibrutinib, and that inhibits a protein called BTK. And the other drug is called idelalisib and inhibits a protein called PI3K-delta. As I mentioned, these are oral agents. They don't have to be given intravenously. And right now, when people go on them, they are given indefinitely. So people are taking pills for a long time, years, unless, of course, they have a bad side effect and have to go off, or unless they lose their response to the drug. So one of the differences between chemotherapy and these newer drugs is that chemotherapy tends to be intravenous, but it's given for a finite period of time, usually for about 6 months, and then the person hopefully is in remission, and then they don't have to be on anything. The pills have a different side effect profile and generally are very well tolerated, more so than chemotherapy, but they're indefinite, and people do have to be on them sometimes for many years. So there's trade-offs. These two new kinases will probably be joined by another oral drug that will be coming to the market this year, and I'll just tell you the name of that, which is venetoclax, and I'll let Dr. Kipps give you more information on that. So in terms of the treatment, again, for most patients right now, it is chemotherapy-based, and even if the patients are in a high-risk group other than 17P, they can usually get several years remission. Once the disease comes back, we generally go with these oral drugs. And you might ask, well, are there any other patients who will be able to get these oral drugs up front? There was recently a randomized trial, meaning patients were randomly assigned, like a flip of a coin, to ibrutinib or to chlorambucil, the rather mild chemotherapy that I told you, and all these people were over the age of 65. And why was that chosen? Well, because they were going to get this mild chemo, which you wouldn't really want to give to a healthier, younger patient because you don't get as long remissions as you get with FCR or BR, which are somewhat more intensive chemos. Well, the randomized trial showed that ibrutinib was better as an initial therapy in older patients, and we do think that the FDA may use this trial to say that ibrutinib can now be given to certain patients besides 17p-deleted patients right up front. But again, I'm going to let Dr. Kipps talk about the details. So these drugs do have some side effects. Ibrutinib can cause diarrhea, but it's usually mild and self-limited. It can also cause an irregular heartbeat called atrial fibrillation. Luckily, that only occurs in about 5 to 10% of patients who take it. And it can cause increased bleeding. That's typically manifested as bruising, so black and blue marks. But rarely a patient can get severe bleeding. Idelalisib can cause an elevation in the liver tests, which you wouldn't really feel as a patient, but you would see in the blood counts, and so we have to monitor for that. It can sometimes cause inflammation in the lungs. Again, that's not common, maybe 5% of patients. And it can sometimes cause a late diarrhea, which can be significant. So it's not that these new drugs don't have side effects, but one of the big benefits that they have is they don't lower the normal white blood cell count. And that's probably the biggest risk when we use chemotherapy, is that we lower the normal white blood cells in addition to the leukemic cells. And the danger of doing that is that you're lowering the cells that fight infection and you make people somewhat more predisposed to infection, at least in the brief time that they're actually on the chemotherapy. So that's probably one of the biggest advantages of these new oral drugs, is that in general they're not causing the other blood counts to go down. In terms of the symptoms, what are the symptoms of the disease? We already discussed that. Sometimes fatigue, sometimes night sweats, in slightly increased risk for infections, which is not that high in people who've never been treated with chemotherapy. Sometimes patients with CLL who are having infections have low gamma globulin levels. So gamma globulin is a protein that fights infections. If people are having recurrent infections, which are typically either sinus infections or pulmonary infections like bronchitis, and they have low gamma globulin levels, that's an indication to give gamma globulin. It's given intravenously, usually once a month. There's no fixed number of doses. Sometimes, let's say, if a patient, particularly from the East Coast, is getting it during the winter, we might continue monthly for a few months and then stop therapy. So although infections can be seen with CLL, that's not necessarily an indication to start chemotherapy. Again, those indications might be large lymph nodes, large spleen, anemia, low platelet counts, et cetera. It's very important to tell your doctor any symptoms that you're having, whether or not they're related. Sometimes people are not sure if a symptom is related, and they're kind of hesitant to tell the doctor. But one always needs to do this because there are certain rare symptoms that people can have that they may not realize are related to the CLL. So it's important to communicate with your healthcare team, whether that be the doctor or the nurse, and tell them any symptoms that you're having, and in particular, any side effects that you might be having from the drug. Again, with idelalisib, the diarrhea is often late. So we've had the experience where patients have been on the drug for a year, and then they get a little diarrhea, and they don't mention it because they think, well, if it's drug-related, it would have happened much longer ago. So certain things like that, the person may reasonably not expect that it's related to the disease and then to the treatment and then turns out that it is. So it's very important to communicate with your healthcare team about your symptoms or about any side effects that you may be having. And I think I'll stop there, Carolyn, and I'll let you introduce Dr. Kipps and let him give more information on the treatment options.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. O'Brien. That was really outstanding, and you really gave lots of information, a lot of key points to people to remember, and particularly to be sure to talk to your healthcare team about any symptom. That's really important, and we'll talk more about that at the end of the call as well. This is really important. And our next speaker is Dr. Thomas Kipps. Dr. Kipps is the Evelyn and Edwin Tash Chair in Cancer Research, Distinguished Professor and Deputy Director of Research Operations, UCSD, Morris Cancer Center. And Dr. Kipps is going to address new and emerging treatment approaches, the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to your treatment options, and clinical trial updates. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Kipps.
Well, thank you. I wish to thank you, and I also wish to thank Dr. O'Brien for her lucid and a very nice summary of the outline for chronic lymphocytic leukemia and some of the treatments that are currently available. It really has been a whirlwind of excitement here with the advent of new drugs that are approved for patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and they fall into different categories, as Dr. O'Brien had mentioned. One category that I'd like to touch upon first is the category of monoclonal antibodies. These are reagents that are made in antibodies which can bind to proteins on the leukemia cell, and it's like having an immune response that's given to you that can be directed against your leukemia. It's very attractive from the standpoint of having a targeted therapy where the antibody will bind to a protein, and by that binding, either change the leukemic cell or force its elimination through the immune system. One antibody that's been used quite a bit now, and there's practically no patients that I know of that have not been introduced to this, is the antibody rituximab. And this antibody binds to a protein called CD20. CD20 is a protein that is found on leukemia cells. It's also found on your normal B cells. So it does not discriminate between normal B cells and CLL cells. Nonetheless, when given to patients, it has been effective in inducing responses with reductions in leukemic cell counts and reductions in the lymph nodes. Rituximab has been used quite extensively in a number of clinical trials. It has married itself really well with combinations of chemotherapy or some of the newer agents. One thing that has been found, though, is that rituximab may, even at high doses, not achieve a home run in terms of being able to eliminate the leukemic cells. And it seems to be, I tell patients, it's probably a much better dance partner than a soloist. It is oftentimes used in combination with other agents. This includes your standard conventional chemotherapy drugs, and Dr. O'Brien mentioned a few of those with fludarabine and cyclophosphamide for the FCR regimen, or bendamustine, which is another chemotherapy drug, the so-called BR regimen. It also can be used, and this is more common in Europe, with chlorambucil, which is an oral drug very similar to the cyclophosphamide, the C in FCR, or the B in bendamustine, but it's taken by mouth, and it's more commonly used in Europe. Now, because of the success of the rituximab in being able to actually enhance the response rates, and in fact, when you look at the data, it seemed like the advent of rituximab was the first to actually demonstrate a survival advantage compared to patients who were not able to receive antibody therapy. There have been other antibodies that have been developed that also target this protein CD20. And so now we have approved not only rituximab for treatment in combination with chemotherapy, we also have approved another antibody called ofatumumab and a newer antibody, obinutuzumab, also known as Gazyva, that's its trade name. Now, obinutuzumab and ofatumumab appear to have striking activity such as rituximab, and what's very striking is the most recent antibody, which is obinutuzumab, appears to have a very active role in clearing leukemic cells quite quickly from the blood and is very active also against the lymph nodes. There was a study conducted by the German CLL study group where they compared patients who were over age 65 who had medical issues that prevented them from taking a very aggressive therapy. And these patients were randomized to receive either chlorambucil, a chemotherapy drug by itself, or chlorambucil and obinutuzumab, or chlorambucil and rituximab. And that allowed for a head-to-head comparison between these three groups. And it was apparent that the treatment with obinutuzumab and chlorambucil was superior than treatment with chlorambucil alone. But also it appears that the obinutuzumab treatment resulted in higher response rates than were seen with rituximab. So I think that this is encouraging based on this study and others that have followed. Obinutuzumab has been approved for treatment of patients as a frontline antibody in combination with drugs such as chlorambucil. Similarly, the ofatumumab in studies where the drug was compared against chlorambucil by itself by the British Yellow Group, this showed improved activity and now has been approved for treatment of patients in a frontline setting as well. So the access to these antibodies is helpful, and many patients can benefit from use of these antibodies. We do have to be attentive to complications. With obinutuzumab, there may be infusion reactions. So when you first get the obinutuzumab, there may be a lot of rigors and distress. This has to be given very slowly and in small amounts at the very beginning. Once the patients become acclimated to the drug, though, they typically do very well. But the first day or two of infusions can be trying, and I think it needs to be done with a lot of attention and medical oversight and monitoring. I recommend getting the drug at medical centers that are used to handling infusion reactions that may take place with any of these antibodies. Now, a number of other antibodies are being developed, but I have to mention one antibody that has been around. It's an antibody called alemtuzumab or CAMPATH, a very effective antibody in targeting leukemic cells within the marrow, and it's been very helpful to try and eradicate what's called minimal residual disease. It doesn't seem to be as active in patients who have enlarged lymph nodes, and I think that the trying nature of this is when you give it to patients with large lymph nodes, you do get immune suppression. And if the leukemia is not in full remission, that immune suppression continues, and the patients may then have a disadvantage of having a weaker immune system than they had before therapy. However, if the patient is able to achieve a complete remission, that immune system does tend to recover. This drug has been taken off the market for treatment of patients with CLL because it's been found to be active and in patients with multiple sclerosis at doses that are less than one-tenth of what were given to leukemia patients. Now, for some reason, the drug then is now costing 10 times more, and they couldn't afford to use it for two indications. So right now, alemtuzumab can be obtained from the manufacturer without cost, but it has to be applied for by the treating institution in which you're receiving it. It has to be given with some care and attention because of the immune suppression that I mentioned. Antibodies have also targeted another protein, CD37, which is on all CLL cells, and there's a number of trials involving different antibodies. Some antibodies also conjugated to toxins so that you can deliver a toxin to the leukemia cells specifically. These studies are ongoing. There's other proteins such as CD19, which is another protein like CD20, that's found on the leukemia cells but also found on B cells. But in phase one clinical trials, this antibody also had activity and good response rates in treated patients. So these antibodies do represent a new approach. We're very excited about an ongoing trial that we have here using a monoclonal antibody directed at what appears to be a leukemia-specific antigen, which is called ROR1. This antibody now is being tested in phase one clinical trials by Dr. Michael Choi and Dr. Kat Jamieson here. And it's quite exciting because unlike the antibodies that I just mentioned, the protein that is targeted by this antibody does not appear to be expressed on normal cells. And so we don't have problems, for example, of compounding immune suppression with these antibodies. Now, Dr. O'Brien mentioned this new category of drug, the so-called kinase inhibitors. This came out of the study on the biology of CLL. Namely, CLL is found not to be, it's actually found to be a social animal. It requires help from its friends in order to survive. And this is done typically in the lymph nodes where it can interact with other cells in the lymph node. And in the lymph node, they may receive survival and growth factors that can sustain the leukemic cell and allow it to grow. Now, the drugs of the kinase inhibitors, such as the inhibitors of a protein called BTK, are the other protein, as I mentioned, which is called PI3 kinase. These proteins are involved in signaling events, some of which are involved in the signals that the leukemia cell needs in order to get stimulated, but also to migrate to the lymph nodes. And so the inhibition of these enzymes short-circuits the ability of the leukemic cell to really find its way home to the lymph nodes. And as a consequence, the lymph nodes tend to get smaller quite early in therapy, and they empty into the blood. So commonly, patients will experience an increase in the white blood cell count with concomitant shrinkage of the lymph nodes. And then over time, there may be reduction in the lymph nodes and in the blood. However, it seems that these kinase inhibitors, by and large, do also not eradicate the disease. There's been no examples, to my knowledge, that these kinase inhibitors have been able to cure patients yet. Patients are advised to continue with these medications, and over time, the white count can go down, and patients may do quite well. So provided they don't have side effects, they may be sustained on therapy with these drugs for many years, and some patients now have been on therapy for more than a few years. That has been actually very gratifying because of the fact that some of the patients that were started on the treatment with these new agents had disease that required therapy, and from historic data, we knew that the therapy would not result in a long-lasting remission with conventional chemotherapy, or they may have developed resistance to chemotherapy such that giving chemotherapy was not considered an option. So patients actually, even though they're taking the medication, may sustain themselves if they continue taking these kinase inhibitors and be able to go about their lives. They're oral drugs so that you can take them at home and then be monitored on a regular basis by your doctor to see if you're having no side effects or whether you're developing something that we all are looking for, is the potential for resistance to these drugs. Should the patients develop resistance, we have other means to examine for this, and a lot of work is now ongoing to look for newer agents that might be able to treat patients who develop resistance to these therapies or who may not be able to tolerate these therapies. Now, I think the studies that have been done have allowed for the approval of the drug ibrutinib, which is an inhibitor of the enzyme BTK. This was done in a trial where the drug was compared against the drug ofatumumab, the monoclonal antibody, one of the anti-CD20 antibodies that I mentioned earlier. And it appeared that the patients who were treated with ibrutinib, they were patients who had received prior therapy and were considered good candidates to receive ofatumumab therapy. And it appeared that there was an overall improvement in progression-free survival, provided the patient stayed on ibrutinib, as well as overall survival advantage. And this was really the trial that allowed for the agency to approve ibrutinib for patients who required therapy after they've had prior therapy. It also noted patients who have a genetic lesion, which is the deletion in the short arm of chromosome 17, those patients actually typically do not respond favorably to chemotherapy. And I would advise not getting chemotherapy if you have leukemic cells that have the so-called 17p deletion. Those patients actually responded quite well to the drug, as well or almost as well as patients who did not have this. So the FDA has approved the use of ibrutinib for patients as a frontline therapy if they have the 17p deletion. Now, we've recently completed a study that was published just a few months ago where patients were given the drug chlorambucil, as I mentioned earlier, versus ibrutinib, and this was done as a frontline study where patients over age 65 received one drug or the other, and it was done on a randomized basis. And it was apparent that those patients that were treated with ibrutinib fared better. They had better responses and longer progression-free survival if they had the ibrutinib treatment versus the chlorambucil treatment. And there's also data to suggest that there's an improvement in the overall survival of patients who were treated with the ibrutinib. It still remains to be seen, though, as to when we should institute trials or institute therapy with ibrutinib, and there are studies to try and ask the question, Is it better to use the therapy as a frontline agent versus to wait until after patients have relapsed after prior treatment? And the other question that's being addressed is it good to take these drugs relatively early, in fact, to avoid the watch and wait period? I think it's probably safe to say that we don't know the answers to those questions, and I have to say that there are no treatment out there that don't have some risks or downside to it, and we followed many patients for years and years, and in fact decades, who have not required therapy and have done quite well without therapy, and I can only guess if they were to be treated, we'd be congratulating ourselves rather than just the fact that their disease was highly indolent. And as Dr. O'Brien mentioned, there are some patients who may benefit tremendously from chemoimmunotherapy and achieve very striking remissions, which can last for many, many years, and go without any evidence of the disease or any side effects. And this is actually not a bad place to be either. So I think that we need to be intelligent, not to throw out what we had in the past, but also to build upon it and to use the drugs that we have rationally so as to achieve the best patient outcome, and to recognize that there's always going to be a downside or a risk to therapy that should hopefully be less than the benefit that is achieved by therapy. Now, there's some newer drugs that are being tested. As you can imagine, the other drug, which is an inhibitor of PI3 kinase called idelalisib, or the trade name Idelic, has also been approved. And this was approved through a study where the drug was compared in combination with rituximab versus rituximab alone. And patients who achieved the combination of Zidelic or idelalisib with the rituximab fared better than patients who received rituximab alone. And based upon the outcome of the data, it was an interim analysis. I remember going over the data, and it was striking that even after halfway completion of the study, it was apparent that patients that were treated with the combination of rituximab and idelalisib actually had an improvement in overall survival compared to patients treated with rituximab alone. And based upon those data, the FDA approved the combination for patients with CLL. As Dr. O'Brien mentioned, there's no free lunch here, and the treatments can cause side effects. We worry about hepatic enzyme elevation, so it's very important to be monitored by your physician, particularly when you start therapy. And there's also some autoimmune problems that patients may develop, either a colitis, which is inflammation of the bowel, or a pneumonitis, which is inflammation of the lungs. And it's very important to receive regular follow-up care from physicians who are familiar with the drug and familiar with the side effects to mitigate the complications that these drugs may have over long-term use. Again, like ibrutinib, idelalisib is recommended to continue as long as the patient is not having any problems with therapy and not having side effects that preclude continued therapy. Other agents now have been developed that target BTK, and there's some newer BTK inhibitors that are being tested in the clinic, and there's probably more to come. Other drugs such as what's called ACP-196 or acalabrutinib is touted to be potentially more specific and maybe with fewer side effects. Of course, that remains to be seen, and head-to-head clinical trials are going to be required in order to really determine whether it's a drug that's easier to use or more effective than ibrutinib. And this is also true with other drugs of that nature, such as the Ono drug 4059. It's clear that we're going to see a lot of drugs potentially come out in the future, similar to the drugs that are available for patients with chronic myelogenous leukemia, where they may have their choice of different kinase inhibitors. And I think what will happen is that we'll be able to use one kinase inhibitor perhaps in combination with potentially monoclonal antibodies or other agents, and if there are side effects or intolerance or resistance, we might be able to have the option to take other kinase inhibitors or other drugs. Now, one very exciting drug category that Dr. O'Brien mentioned was the use of BCL-2 inhibitors. Now, what is BCL-2? BCL-2 is sort of like the shield, the energy shield around the Enterprise, which protected it against the photons. BCL-2 protects the leukemic cells from dying. And if there's high levels of BCL-2, which we find in CLL cells, then the cells are resistant to being killed by either chemotherapy drugs or being killed just by themselves. So the targeting of BCL2 has been attractive for many years, and there have been a variety of different inhibitors of BCL2 that have been tested. We've tested some earlier ones, one drug called navitoclax, or ABT-263, was quite effective in treatment of patients with CLL, but it had side effects in terms of reducing the platelet count. Another drug, which is very specific for BCL2, called venetoclax, or ABT-199, has been very effective in treatment as monotherapy. This is a orally active drug that can be taken, and in clinical trials has actually resulted in about a quarter of the patients achieving a complete remission. Some of these patients have had no evidence of residual disease on their marrow biopsies after several months of therapy. And one word of caution, though, is that these drugs are quite powerful. Even though they're taken by mouth as a pill, they can result in very aggressive tumor lysis. And the tumor lysis can be so fulminant that the tumor can release the contents of the cell into the circulation. And too much is not a good thing. What may happen is that the level of an electrolyte called potassium can go up to high levels, and this can interfere with the conduction of the heart, for example, when it gets to be too high, and there can be then cardiac arrest if the potassium level is too high. Unfortunately, the only symptoms from this may be when the heart is not beating, and so I think that what has to be done is when these drugs are first started, patients have to be very carefully monitored for any elevations in potassium or other factors which can indicate tumor lysis, and there's ways of addressing this so that you can avoid that very serious complication. So these drugs are not to be taken lightly. When you first start the drug, it may result in tumor lysis, particularly if you have a lot of tumor to be lysed. So patients with very large lymph nodes or very high white counts, or both, are at higher risk than patients who have very low tumor burdens. And those patients, once they get started on therapy, can usually remain on therapy. We've now had patients on therapy for several years that have fared quite well, and they don't have this risk of fulminant tumor lysis after they get initiated on therapy. Now, as you might imagine, in oncology, there's a push to try and combine drugs. There are several trials that are being considered to combine this drug, venetoclax, with potentially a kinase inhibitor, such as ibrutinib, as well as with other kinase inhibitors, as well as with monoclonal antibodies. And I think that each of these drugs has targets that are different and distinct from each other's. Each have had different mechanisms of activity. And what may be particularly exciting in the future is to find the right combination that may allow us to eradicate the tumor completely and prevent it from coming back. This is our hope. Currently, what the management of CLL is to try and make this more of a chronic treatment disorder where you take a kinase inhibitor for a prolonged period of time. However, I foresee a day when we might be able to use selective therapy that can hopefully eradicate the disease and one day ultimately cure patients with this disease. So I think it's very exciting this time, and I think the future is very bright for patients. I didn't mention some of the more research-oriented techniques, such as the use of chimeric antigen receptor modified T cells, and I just want to make that kind of a brief mention. It's possible to take your T cells out and to actually use a gene that encodes a what's called a chimeric receptor. What happens is that your T cells will express a protein, a surface protein that acts like an antibody that can target an antigen or a protein on the leukemia cell and go after it and kill it, as the T cell might do if it had an immune response against the virus-infected cell. And so patients' leukemic cells and T cells may be removed from by process called apheresis. The T cells can be isolated and modified to express this chimeric antigen receptor, or CAR, and they can be given back to the patient to induce an anti-tumor response. Now, the responses have been mixed. There have been some spectacular responses, and a couple of patients have been able to eradicate their leukemic cells, as well as all B cells, because the protein that this T cell targets is expressed on all B cells. Most patients have achieved maybe a partial response or no response at all. And some of the patients who particularly have responded very well have actually gotten quite sick in the process, when the T cells are being activated and going after the leukemic cells, they tend to release inflammatory proteins that can make the patient have high fevers and problems in breathing. And so this has to be done under careful management in a very sophisticated medical center. I think we really do need to understand this technique to try and make it improved or better for all patients, and not just have spectacular home runs for one or two patients. And it's difficult right now to factor where this will be in the context of all the other new agents that I just had opportunity to discuss with you today. So I think that still we need to continue on with efforts to develop these new strategies as others if we're going to really achieve the hope for outcome, which is to achieve curative therapy for all patients with CLL. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Kiffs. That was really quite the tour de force and covering quite a lot of new and emerging treatments and really really covering quite a bit. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Caroline Edlund. Ms. Edlund is an oncology social worker, and she's our online support group program director at Cancer Care, and she will be addressing Cancer Care's free psychosocial services and programs and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Edlund.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of the call today. I would like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with CLL and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways that we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends, and are experienced in helping people to manage the emotional, physical, and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices in the New York City area, as well as telephone and online groups. These groups offer a unique opportunity to talk with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we've learned from today's program, there's a lot of information to digest and make sense of. Our social workers can help you understand what this all means for you and your family. A Cancer Care social worker can help you prioritize and consider the questions that you might want to ask to get the answers and information you need. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care services are there to help. So please contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE or 4673, or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology social work support. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to speak today.
Thank you so much, Caroline. That was really wonderful. And now we have time for questions, and I'm going to ask Candace to explain to everybody how to queue up for questions and to bring all of our speakers on board so we can address the questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible, and if we don't get to your question, I will explain to all of you how to get your questions answered so we will have no one left kind of not getting a question or answered or getting it answered in the future. So, Candace, if you could if you could explain to everybody, we're going to do our best to take as many as possible.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Sue O. Your line is now open.
Hi. I want to talk to Dr. O'Brien. I don't know if it matters, but I have CLL. I am a social worker, and my doctor, luckily for me, is Conti Rai. And I wanted to first to say that that Dr. Wright has a clinical staging system and that he does have a zero stage for when you have absolutely no symptoms, no lymph nodes, nothing, your blood work is normal, everything is okay.
And your question?
My question is, you mentioned 17p deletion, and I was told by Dr. Wright that it's like an older disease also, like in the 60s and 70s, and I was diagnosed on my 50th birthday, and I don't understand why I got it so young, and I was wondering what the difference was between ZAP 70 negative and 17p deletion.
Well, thank you. That's an excellent question. And actually, there are a few questions from online participants about younger people with CLL as well. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask Dr. O'Brien to address your question in a general way, and so it'll help everyone on the call. And then we definitely advise you, Sue, to go back to your treating healthcare team with the information that you learned today. So, and there are, just to kind of elaborate on that just slightly, there is another question about younger people with CLL and also their expectations as CLL progresses over their lifetime. So that's just another component of what about young people with cancer, so with CLL. So Dr. O'Brien, could you address this again in a general way?
Yes, I mean, it is true that the average age is about 70, but remember, an average is just where the average person comes in. There's always going to be people on either side of the average. So some people are older and some people are much younger. There is no impact of age on the outcome of the disease in the following sense. It's not that younger patients have more aggressive disease or less aggressive disease. If they have RI stage 0, their disease should behave as somebody who might be 80 who has RI stage 0 disease and vice versa. So in that sense, there's no impact of age, but of course there is an impact of age in the sense that although I said about a third of patients may never need treatment, obviously if the person gets diagnosed when they're in their 70s and the normal lifespan is to 80, then that person is much more likely to go without treatment than someone who's diagnosed in their 50s. So in that sense, it does impact to be younger just because your expected lifespan is so much greater. But the disease doesn't appear to behave differently. In terms of ZAP70 is a protein inside the cell. The 17p deletion is a chromosomal abnormality. They don't really have anything in common except that they both, if either is present or both, they imply that the disease is higher risk. So there's a couple of things that we look at to predict if a disease is more likely to progress sooner than later. In other words, is this going to be a person who goes 10 years without treatment, or is this going to be a person who goes 2 years? And some of the things we look at, we've already mentioned, 17p deletion, the presence of two proteins that can be inside the cell. One is called ZAP70. One is called CD38, and we look at, I mentioned, the heavy chain, which is always found in B cells. We look at whether that's mutated or not. So these are just a number of different prognostic factors that we can look at to try and predict how the disease is going to behave.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have a question also from one of our online participants, from Cheney. I've heard exercise increases the white blood count. How should people with CLL exercise and not worry about the increases? Dr. Kipps, could you address that question, please?
Well, exercise, I think, is very beneficial, provided I think the patient combines it with a healthy lifestyle. Exercise can actually stimulate release of adrenaline. Adrenaline, when given to patients, can actually increase neutrophil counts and not the lymphocyte count so much. And so it's possible to get an increase in white count with very vigorous exercise that's sufficient to release adrenaline into the system. This is a very transient effect and should really have no basis or bearing on the progression of the disease adversely affect the outcome of patients with this disease. So I encourage people to stay active, and if you can maintain your health, I do think it helps to maintain surveillance against infection, as well as to potentially bolster one's immune defenses, even in terms of checking one's own CLL, if that's possible.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have a question from another online participant, Claudette. I am 73 years old, diagnosed 12 years ago. White blood cell count 228,000, no symptoms, 5 feet tall, 112 pounds. Do I have the same chemo dosage as a large person? Which I think people often wonder about. So I'm going to just ask Dr. O'Brien again if you could address this in a general way, and then we, of course, advise Claudette to go back to our treating healthcare team with that question as well. It's a good question, but all the details, of course, matter. But if, Dr. O'Brien, you could address it generally.
So chemotherapy doses are actually based on height and weight. We look at something called body surface area, which, again, is a combination of height and weight, and that is how we adjust the doses. So chemotherapy is definitely adjusted for the size of the person. The newer molecules, ibrutinib and idelalisib, the pills, are not dosed based on weight or height. They're just flat doses, which are given to everybody. So the chemo dosing, however, is definitely based on the size of the person.
Well, thank you. Excellent. And next question for Dr. Kipps. How important do you feel getting the disease into a deeper clinical response is to long-term outcomes? That's a general question, if you could address this in a general way.
Well, I think that if we are to try and affect what we might consider a cure for patients with this disease, we're probably going to have to certainly eradicate the leukemia cells. And as techniques have improved, we're improving our ability to detect leukemic cells. The most sensitive repository is the marrow. Patients have leukemic cells that are almost everywhere, but they tend to home to the marrow, so it's the most sensitive site to look for leukemic cells. And using some of the newer techniques, it's quite easy to obtain detection of leukemic cells when they're present at 1 in 10,000 cells. And some of the new sequencing techniques that we and others are using can detect 1 in a million cells. Now, obviously, if a patient is treated with a, for example, chemoimmunotherapy regimen and achieves a complete remission without any evidence of the disease, and we can't detect any leukemic cells in the marrow, that really does augur very well for a long-term progression-free survival where they do not have to require therapy again. And I think this is something that people are taking notice of. It's not used in the treatment of patients with these kinase inhibitors because it's very unusual to achieve that degree of remission. But I do think we have the newer drug, the BCL-2 inhibitor, venetoclax, where we have had some patients achieve that degree of remission, and that has allowed us to stop therapy and just to follow the patients. And in some cases, we have patients now that are being followed for a period of time longer than they were on therapy, and that's after having achieved a complete remission with absence of any minimal residual disease. So I think it depends on the type of therapy, but the outcome certainly appears to be very bright for those patients who are able to successfully achieve what's called MRD negative complete responses.
Excellent, thank you. And our next question from Hillary, how are CLL and small cell lymphoma different? When I try to read about SCL, I find very little, but often see that CLL is the reference point. Dr. O'Brien, could you address this question, please?
Right. So the cells in SLL, or small lymphocytic lymphoma, and CLL are pretty much the same. The big difference is that we call CLL leukemia because the person has an elevated white blood cell count, whereas with SLL, people can have bone marrow involvement, like with CLL, but they generally don't have as much, and the cells don't circulate. So, again, because leukemia is the disease where you have circulating cells in the blood, that's the distinction. From a practical point of view, most clinical trials, for example, nowadays, will say that patients are eligible if they have SLL or CLL, because we know that they behave very similarly and they respond to the same treatments. So you can more or less think of SLL as CLL without an elevated white blood cell count in practical terms.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question, which is kind of a combined. I'm going to combine it. How do you determine which monoclonal antibody to give a patient? And the follow-up to that is, how do you determine which inhibitor to put a patient on, from Lisa? Dr. Kipps, could you address that question?
Well, that's
question again. It's a complicated.
It's a very good question, and a lot of the clinical studies right now are aiming to answer that question better. I think that right now the FDA has approved the use of the kinase inhibitors as a more or less second-line therapy after patients have been treated and relapsed from therapy that involves some form of chemoimmunotherapy. This is probably from patients who are not receiving it under clinical trial would be the options for a practicing physician treating a patient is to give it to patients who've relapsed after prior therapy. There is an exception, though, for those patients who have leukemic cells with 17P. I think that the use of different antibodies, rituximab is something that is quite commonly used, and because of the familiarity with it and people have responded well to it, it's oftentimes used in combination with different agents such as chemotherapy. But the data on the obinutuzumab appears to be very exciting, so if there's a preference, we tend to consider obinutuzumab, the newer anti-CD20, over rituximab when given in combination with these chemotherapy drugs. We've also been able to do this in combination with glucocorticoids with a very good degree of success, too. So I think that the question you have is a very good one. I would suggest that first you have to get evaluated, make sure that the genetics of your leukemic cells are examined. If you have the 17P deletion, then chemotherapy would be something to avoid, and to use some of these newer agents would be probably preferred. And as far as monoclonal antibodies, I would say that these are questions that are still being addressed in clinical trials. Rituximab is an excellent antibody, as is ofatumumab and obinutuzumab. And I could say that they're very similar, but maybe different degrees of activity. I think the newer antibodies have sometimes potential to have more infusion-related reactions. That's typical for obinutuzumab, as I mentioned earlier. However, those can be managed and used quite well in the clinic if the staff are experienced in handling those side effects. But I think that there's not really a adopted algorithm right now. I would say that the obinutuzumab and ofatumumab, the two new anti-CD20 antibodies, have been approved by the FDA as part of frontline therapy. And rituximab has been approved for use in combination with fludarabine and cyclophosphamide, or with bendamustine, it's more common. And so your physician may opt to look at the patient and try to figure out what might be the best combination, the one that your physician is most familiar with to manage. And I think if I could leave with that, there's still open debate as to different types of regimens or different combinations, and those are ongoing in an investigation.
Well, I want to thank our speakers. You have been extraordinary, and I have to say the questions have been really amazing questions. I want to thank all of you who've asked questions. I want to thank our speakers and all of you who've been listening. I just want to remind everyone this is a one-hour workshop, and that although the workshop is soon to end, the services you can access and the answers to your questions, that does not end. So I just wanted to go over that. For any of you who still have some medical questions that you did not get answered and really or think of a question after the call that you want to get an answer to, I very much recommend that you contact the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. Again, 1-800-422-6237. And their staff, their information specialists are there, and they kind of await your calls after each of our workshops so that basically they are there to answer your questions. And for those of you who would like to access any of the free services from Cancer Care, so any financial or practical assistance, counseling services, joining a support group or an online group or telephone group, or just to get some more information, materials, you can contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. Again, that's 1-800-813-4673. Again, as we conclude today's program, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with CLL and coping with cancer. As a caregiver, I want you to know that you're now part of the Cancer Care community, and as such, you are really a telephone call away, or you can certainly visit our website as well, but you're always kind of in close touch with us whenever you have an issue or concern. And so I want to thank you all for participating today and for being such a very informed audience. You had asked us really wonderful questions. And I want to thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.